We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking with two people about a double homicide that happened in Paris, Illinois. We're talking with the author of a book called Too Politically Sensitive. Since When Is Murder Too Politically Sensitive? By Mike Callahan. We're also talking with Professor Larry Golden from the University of Illinois at Springfield, who is the director of the Downstate Innocence Project that helped find the evidence, along with things that Mike Callahan found when he was a lieutenant for the Illinois State Police about this murder case. Welcome to both of you.
Steve, thank you for having me.
And Larry, can you hear me all right?
I can. Thank you very much.
Very good. And Larry, thank you particularly for going to the extra effort when you're out on the East Coast to talk to us by phone about this important case and about your project. Let's begin with you, Mike. Now, you had been a undercover narcotics officer in the Chicago area for the State Police of Illinois for how long before you got involved in this case?
Well, I started with the Illinois State Police in 1980, and I spent 18 years in the Chicago area, and I came here in the year 2000.
And you
1998.
All right. And you described in your book, Too Politically Sensitive, that you worked undercover, you were often scruffy-looking and bearded like I am now when you were working doing narcotics, and you had a rather impressive career. You put a lot of people behind bars who were running drugs, and as a result, you were promoted eventually to sergeant and master sergeant and finally lieutenant. And where did you get assigned when you were a lieutenant for the Illinois State Police?
Well, I transferred from Chicago to East Central Illinois at Champaign in 1998. I was a master sergeant at that time, and then I became a newly appointed lieutenant in 2000.
And where had you lived before coming to East Central? You've been in the Chicago area?
Yes, the Chicago suburbs is where I lived, but I worked most of northern Cook County, Kane County, McHenry County, a little bit of DuPage County and Lake County.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Indiana, Terre Haute, Indiana.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Terre Haute South, and I went to Indiana University.
I've heard of Indiana University. It's nearby, I think.
Not real popular here in Champaign.
And did you go immediately into police work?
I worked on my master's degree, and then during that time I applied to several state agencies. I thought about going into the FBI. I worked briefly for 2 years with Westinghouse Credit while I was applying to those, and then I finally was accepted to the Illinois State Police.
And when you were accepted with the Illinois State Police, you tell in your book that you took the oath of office. Let me read that oath that all officers, people hired by the Illinois State Police, take. To be honest in thought, word, and deed, to maintain unimpeachable integrity, to be just, fair, and impartial, to be steadfast against evil and its temptations, and to give my utmost to protect the rights, property, and lives of our citizens. I will never compromise with crime and shall at all times uphold the constitutions and law of my country and the state of Illinois. What did that oath mean to you?
Well, it meant everything to me from my adult life. You become a police officer, and the state police is a very proud organization. And you live believing that no one is above the law, that we will always do the right thing. And no matter what, that we are that fine line between good and bad.
Well, let's get to the heart of this book, your book, and this case that the Downstate Innocence Project was also very, very involved with. There was a murder of two people, a married couple, young married couple in Paris, Illinois. By the time you were given this case, It was 14 years old. Tell us what bothered you about it.
I received the assignment to review the investigation after the Downstate Innocence Project and the Center for Wrongful Conviction questioned the innocence of, or the guilt of, Randy Steidel and Herb Whitlock. They felt the two men were innocent and had been wrongfully convicted.
So these were two people who were tried, convicted, sent to jail, one with a death penalty, one with life imprisonment.
Yes, and for the murder of Dyke and Karen Rhodes.
And you felt that they were, from evidence you found very quickly, that they, you felt they were innocent.
Well, I reviewed the case file. I had a very short turnaround. The case was going to air on 48 hours, so that obviously caused a lot of concern within the Illinois State Police and Governor George Ryan's administration at the time that there may be some scandal. And as I looked at our case file, looked at the information provided by the Innocence Project, it was easy to see that there was a lot of exculpatory evidence withheld in this case.
Let me bring Larry Golden into the conversation. Professor, you, why did the Downstate Innocence Project get involved in this particular case in Paris, Illinois?
Well, there are two reasons, really. I mean, one was that the person who was most central to everything Mike's talking about is a private investigator by the name of Bill Clutter, who is the person who is also the co-director. He's the director of investigations, actually, for the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project. And Clutter got involved, you know, fairly early in this case.
Why did he pick it?
Well, he got involved, actually, I believe, through one of the attorneys that had been working for Randy Steidel at the time. And then later on, particularly, got involved with the attorneys for Herb Whitlock. And then he brought the case into the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project purview. And when we look at cases, we look to see initially about the adequacy of the evidence in the case as one of the big questions that gets raised as to what was the evidence that resulted in the conviction of the individuals and how strong was it. The other criteria that we use is includes the length of sentence involved, because, as Mike knows, most of these cases, it takes years to get the convictions overturned. And so we're particularly interested in looking at cases of people who are going to be in prison for quite a while that we can help and are not at the end of their sentence.
Now, you teach a course at the University of Illinois in Springfield on wrongful convictions.
That's correct.
Tell me about that course.
Well, I mean, trying to keep this brief, what happened is that in the early 1990s, there was a major shift in the whole issue of forensic science with the development of DNA. And new techniques in DNA that were able to demonstrate using very minute and old amounts of evidence whether somebody actually was involved in a crime, assuming that the evidence was there to be tested. A whole series of exonerations began to occur, particularly people on death row around the country, and they started to look at why those individuals were convicted in the first place. And what they found was that there's a series of factors that go into, that are common to the convictions of these people, even though they were innocent. For example, the most outstanding reason why people get convicted, believe it or not, is eyewitness misidentification.
Yes.
In Illinois, we've got a particularly strong history in Chicago of false confessions, but that's true throughout the country. About 25 to 30% of the cases involve false confessions. Inadequate representation. Bad forensic science. You know, people are watching these forensic science shows, and
they think it happens.
You know,
think it's all the time.
and the problem is that the forensic science generally is not terribly reliable once you get outside of DNA. So there are a whole series of reasons people were being convicted, and what we try to do with our students is to take them through a discussion of the various reasons why people are being wrongfully convicted, And what the implications are for the criminal justice and the legal systems.
So are these students who take this course people who are going to be attorneys, people who are going to be in the justice system, be police people, what?
All of those.
All of those.
It's a very broad mix of students. I've had students in the class who are interested in going, a number of them are interested in going to law school. We've had a number of students who have enrolled in the class who were interested in going to law school, who this really changed their whole career.
Now tell me how,
what they wanted to do.
Tell me how Bill Clutter, as the Director of Investigations, how is he funded? How is the Downstate Innocence Project funded?
Yeah, it's funded right now totally through private donations. We exist within the University of Illinois at Springfield, and the university has been generous enough to be able to pay our overhead and some of our staff expenses, but our investigations and the heart of our work is all funded through private donations, which tremendously limits the number of investigations.
Number of cases you can take on, sure.
On any particular time.
Now, for people who are listening to this who might want to find out more about giving a donation to the Downstate Innocent Project, how may they find that online?
There is a website. You can, of course, Google the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project. The website is innocenceproject.edu.
Great. innocenceproject.edu.
I hope I've got that right.
All right, thanks.
Because I don't have that in front of me.
All right. You are traveling, and we're grateful for your participation. Let me switch back to Mike Callahan. But before I do, let me say two things very quickly. One, this is a live call-in show here on WILL AM 580. And listeners can call in with questions or comments. All we ask is that you keep your comments or questions brief so we can let our guests respond. In Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455 if you would like to if you'd like to comment or ask a question. That's 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455. We'll get you to our engineer, Kyle Croa, who will put you in line to be live on the air with our guests today, who are Professor Larry Golden, director of the Downstate Innocent Project, and I do have confirmation now that the website is innocenceproject.org. So it's not EDU, it's just Innocence.
No, the innocenceproject.org is the national.
Oh, that's the national one. Oh, I see. Okay.
It's not the Downstate.
So yours is EDU.
Okay. Ours may be innocenceproject.uis.org.
All right. Well,
I don't have it in front of me.
Well, we'll find out before very long, I promise.
Okay.
And our other guest is Mike Callahan. And let me spell Mike's name because if you want to find his book, Too Politically Sensitive, that's T-O-O, of course. His name as author is Michael Callahan, and Michael's spelled in an unusual way. It's M-I-C-H-A-L-E. It looks like Michael Callahan, but it's pronounced Michael. So if you're interested in that book, you may find it under Too Politically Sensitive, Michael Callahan or Michael Callahan. Mike, getting back to you, what happened when you got this case file on your desk as a new lieutenant in the Illinois State Police and you started reading through some of the material?
When I started initially got the case, I got two very suspicious phone calls from the former supervisor of the investigation and then the actual case agent.
These are other police
and these
officers.
These were the officers that handled the original investigation.
For the state police.
Yes, and they had very much concern over the fact that I was reviewing this case to the point where they were saying, don't make us old guys look bad, and we didn't want to ruin their reputation, which obviously that set off a few bells inside my head because this had been a case they allegedly solved, and they convicted two men, put one on death row and one in life or prison. So it's an unusual thing for two officers to be concerned if they'd done the right thing. As I started looking at the case file was very sloppy. Not too much went by protocol of the Illinois State Police, our policies. And then as you start looking at the actual case file, some of the other information provided, you see that they used these two unbelievable eyewitnesses that had absolutely no credibility, and their stories weren't even straight. And then,
so there were contradictions within the evidence that was presented.
Yeah, contradictions by both the eyewitnesses, and then you get into the fact that you start seeing evidence and information that's been purposely withheld by the investigators that would have led towards the, either the innocence of Steidel and Whitlock or other suspects that had been ignored in this case.
Now, what other roadblocks were put up rather quickly as you started to investigate further?
Like I said, I was given a very short time to review this case. It was about mid-April, late April, that I got the case to review. And 48 Hours was going to air a show on May 15th.
The television show, 48
Hours. The television show. Uh-huh. I did submit a memorandum early May, which said I believed that neither man had been convicted guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and this case needed to be reinvestigated. And there was other suspects. And again, I attacked the credibility of the two eyewitnesses. Initially, I was told that we could reopen the case, and then one of the suspects was a wealthy businessman who was connected to George Ryan, and when I informed our upper command that he was a campaign contributor to George Ryan, for whatever reason, shortly after that, I was brought in along with my captain, and we were told we could no longer reinvestigate the Rhodes case. It was too politically sensitive.
And there were two Ryans involved. There was James Ryan, the Attorney General at that time, right?
Yes.
For the state, and then George Ryan, not related, but the same spelling of the last name, and it turns out that this businessman in Paris was a suspect, but had made substantial political donations to both the Attorney General and the then governor. That governor now, of course, most people know, is serving time for having been convicted by the federal investigators, not by the Illinois State Police. One of the things you mentioned in your book that I want to bring up as one of our issues for today is who polices the police. And when the police
refuse to police themselves,
are doing wrong, what can citizens do?
You know, that's a good question. I asked that question because obviously now the Supreme Court of the United States has taken away freedom of speech or First Amendment protections from government employees. So,
including the police.
Including the police. So if you're a police officer and you see another police officer commit a crime and you're told to be silent, you don't have the First Amendment protections to speak out on that. And governments basically have a green light to commit a crime and then cover it up, which I think is very frightening to all of us.
Professor Golden, this has been one of the themes throughout Mike Callahan's book, Too Politically Sensitive, that that this fairly recent ruling by the Supreme Court, based on a fairly recent law, taking away the right of government employees to that kind of freedom, is a problem. How do you feel from your perspective as a professor?
Well, it's not even just from my sense as a professor, but also my experience with the Innocence Project. The fact of the matter is that even with the right that Mike had before, it wasn't being exercised that often because of the culture of our police departments. And the fact of the matter is that we know that holding the police and state's attorneys and even our judges accountable for these kinds of behavior is extremely difficult, and it has been. I mean, probably the standard example was the killing of Jeanine Nicarico in the Rolando Cruz Alejandro Hernandez case, where a whole series of officials, seven of them, were actually indicted, this included, you know, attorneys and people in law enforcement, and they were all never able to get any convictions to hold those people accountable for what they did to those two individuals, even though there was tremendous irresponsibility and probably illegality that occurred. So it's extremely difficult to hold these people accountable, and as Mike knows, it's not been a common occurrence for people in the law enforcement community to speak out. He is as I always tell my students, he's one of my heroes.
And you've had him come and speak to your class,
you know,
I know.
Yeah, when he comes and speaks to my class, to you know, even interested people, because Mike was able to cut through that and have the courage to stand up at the risk of his career, his livelihood, you know, to some degree his own personal
safety,
comfort,
sure.
Safety, you know, and tackle this. And, you know, but I would also say that this particular case is probably the prototype. It's the extreme that starts with corruption right down at the very local level with a crime that was probably framed and potentially involved organized crime that is very deeply rooted in a small community where it appears that the officials that were in charge of all of the law enforcement functions within that community shared in the corruption, from everything we can tell. And so it's a pretty extreme example, but it's not the only one. And as I say, the Nicarico case, and you mentioned Jim Ryan. Jim Ryan was became state's attorney in DuPage County at that time, and tried to build his career on the conviction of those two individuals. And he's running for governor now, and recently came out and apologized for his role in that, because he understands that it's become a huge public issue in terms of this kind of irresponsibility.
Let me reintroduce our guest for people who may have tuned in late. Professor Larry Golden is the voice you've just been hearing, speaking to us by phone from the East Coast. He's professor of at the University of Illinois in Springfield and head of the Downstate Innocence Project. The co-director of that is Bill Clutter, who is the director of investigations for the Downstate Innocence Project. Is that an official nonprofit organization, Professor?
It is.
It is. So people who make donations, and you can find that, just Google Illinois Innocence Project, and you'll be able to find the website. I found it very, very easily that way, if you'd like to learn more about it. We're also talking with author Michael Callahan of Too Politically Sensitive, T-O-O. Let me give one quick disclaimer. We'll be continuing to talk about this miscarriage of justice that finally was righted after its innocent people who were finally shown to be innocent after they'd served many years in state prisons, one on death row. There are many facts in this book that came out in the investigation by Mike Callahan when he was a lieutenant of the Illinois State Police over a 9-county region. But he says in this book early on, and let me repeat this, that the suspects identified in this case are just that, only suspects. No one is accused of murder. No one has been charged with murder. No one has ever been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for the brutal murders of Dyke and Karen Rhodes, that's spelled R-H-O-A-D-S, including the two men wrongfully convicted. Mike, tell us, let me give the phone numbers again for people who might like to make a question or join the conversation. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455. If you're listening elsewhere, including on the Internet, this program can be heard live, like many WILL programs, at will.illinois.edu, and then click on AM on your computer. Also, this program, if you missed part of it, will be archived and available at that same website after about a week. Mike, how did eventually these two men who were sent to prison and one on death row get freed?
Well, first of all, I was removed from investigations, and ironically, the day after I was removed from investigations, federal judge Michael McCuskey issued an order to the state of Illinois to retry Randy Steidel or free him.
And at the federal courthouse here in Champaign.
Yes, and his order was yes, and his order was very thorough, and basically it summarized that acquittal for Randy Steidel was reasonably assured if the jury had heard all the evidence, which obviously went back to what I was saying, that there had been evidence withheld, which showed that these men were innocent.
So this did have to go to federal court for that to happen.
It's for Randy Steidel.
Yes.
Yes. Randy Steidel was in the federal system at this point. Herb Whitlock was still at the state level.
And what about Herb Whitlock?
Then Randy's case fell to the Illinois Attorney General's office, Lisa Madigan, who reviewed the case for approximately 1 year. And in 2004, she concurred that evidence favorable to the defense had never been turned over, that there was Brady violations. And then it fell to the appellate prosecutor's office, who decided they would not retry the case. Randy was freed. Exact same unbelievable eyewitnesses, the exact same fabricated evidence that would ultimately free Randy Steidel, though Herb Whitlock stayed in prison for another 4 years until a state appellate court would also concur that evidence favorable to his defense had been withheld.
And let me make a comment about that.
Yes, Larry Golden.
Because you had mentioned it earlier, one of the big distinctions here was that Randy Steidel was initially given the death penalty. And in Illinois, what happens is that if you're given the death penalty, or if the death penalty is being asked for, or you're sentenced to death, you get tremendous amounts of resources provided by the state to defend you and to ultimately prove you're innocent. Herb Whitlock, ironically, had the misfortune of not getting sentenced to death or being asked to, and as a result of that, he was languishing in prison without the resources to defend himself that Randy Steidel had. And at the end, it was as the result of two wonderful attorneys, Richard Kling and Susanna Ortiz with Kent University College of Law, who were working with our students, were assisting in the Herb Whitlock case that eventually got Herb out. And it was partly for that reason that he was in prison for 4 years longer than Randy had been. And
yes,
it's a real miscarriage in this state that the state will not provide the resources to defend people
who get a life sentence. Yeah. What? Tell our listeners how many years these two people spent in prison before they were found to be innocent by courts of law.
Randy spent a little over 17 years in prison, 12 of those years on death row, and Herb Whitlock almost 21 years.
Now, both of those people are now free, and as we would suspect, they have made lawsuits against a number of folks who they felt railroaded them into prison. Do either of you want to make a comment about that?
Well, first of all, let me just say that there's also an important distinction to be made. Neither Randy nor Herb at this point are out from under the potential oppression of the legal system. They have not been legally exonerated and pardoned. You know, while it would probably be a little bit more difficult right now for them to go after Randy, they might find a way of doing that, and I'm sure that Mike can talk about that. So it's a very difficult situation for people like that. The state has not been willing to clearly state that these two individuals are innocent, and it's outrageous that they're having to live in any way right now under the cloud of potential state litigation.
Tell us who has said they were innocent.
Well, the courts have released them from prison.
Yes.
Basically, in both cases, saying that the evidence that had been used to convict them was totally inadequate. And therefore, the rulings of the courts by which they were convicted had been nullified.
Okay. And so the distinction is that the prosecuting attorneys could still bring a case again using other evidence. Is that accurate?
Yes, if they were to acquire other evidence. The state police has been allegedly reinvestigating this case since 2003. And shortly after I was removed, but I know they're no longer investigating the case. They had one officer assigned to the case, and he recently retired, and he's actually had a lawsuit filed against him by both individuals that were in this for part of his part in the wrongful convictions.
Uh-huh. Let's talk a little bit about what happened to you, Mike. How did your commanders, people above you in the hierarchy of the state police, respond? And let me quickly say that you say many times in this book there are many very good officers of the Illinois State Police, but there were some who you had problems with because of this being a political issue.
This isn't a reflection at all against the Illinois State Police. I love the Illinois State Police. It's a very fine organization, and the majority of the men and women are good officers and care very much, and they believe in the oath they took. I believe that this is just an example of few when politics interfere with a search for the truth or justice. And I went forward several occasions, five occasions, to get this case reinvestigated. And each time, myself and other officers that supported this were stopped. Eventually, I was removed from investigations, and ultimately, the case has still remained an unsolved homicide. So when you look at some of the victims, you can't forget Dyke and Karen Rhodes or their family. Can you imagine the injustice they must feel that they've had a loved one murdered and nobody's trying to search for the truth and never has?
Yeah.
I'm going to go a little bit farther than Mike, who probably both can't and won't because of his association and even his beliefs, throw this arrow a little bit clearer. When Mike says it's not a reflection of the Illinois State Police, I want to refine that and say it may not be a refinement of the average officer in the Illinois State Police, but it definitely is a reflection of what has happened in terms of the politicization of the Illinois State Police, particularly at the upper levels of the administrative staff.
Had that happened before Governor George Ryan, or?
Well, I want Mike to speak to that because there's a real distinction here to be made that's very important in terms of the listener's understanding as to what's happened to the Illinois State Police.
Yes.
The biggest distinction came under the George Ryan administration. That's when many of us, I'm not saying the upper command of the state police was never politicized, but if it was, we never saw it at our levels. But when George Ryan became governor, the upper command of the state police drastically changed. We lost experienced command officers that were experienced in all fields, investigations and patrol, and they were replaced with what we called politically correct individuals, basically yes men and women. And George Ryan started and continued for the next years under Governor Blagojevich.
And so when Blagojevich came in as a so-called reformed candidate and was elected governor not only once but twice, you felt that from your perspective, looking at what was happening in the Illinois State Police, that there was that it was still being used as a political arm of
yes.
the governor's office.
Morale was down during the George Ryan administration, and we all had hope when Blagojevich came in under his ethics reform, but that became insightful once the upper command never changed under his administration and the same people stayed in charge.
Uh-huh. Any comment on that situation, Professor Golden?
Well, I think that this, one of the strongest parts of the book that Mike wrote, for those who aren't necessarily interested in the case itself, is his description towards the end of the book of what happened to the Illinois State Police. I would encourage people to look at that and read it, and to understand part of what's an extension of the problem that we have in this state. It's not only this state, in terms of the role that politics plays in terms of determining justice and injustice, and supporting, in fact, injustice in some cases, which is directly contrary to the mission and the goals and what we hope for as citizens in terms of the state. I mean, fortunately, there's been at least some shift in the highest level of the Illinois State Police right now, and we're just going to have to wait and see what happens under Governor Quinn and whoever, gets elected next year. But I think citizens need to be demanding of our officials that this kind of activity be rooted out and dealt with, and that particularly, I mean, all of us, I think, have grown up, with the belief and the desire to trust you know, those who protect us on the streets. And as a general rule, I think Mike was trying to say those people should be supported and trusted. But when you have people who come in who are engaged in this kind of politicization and protecting, if you will, in fact, ultimately protecting criminal elements, it's dangerous to everyone.
When I was in seminary in Chicago in the 60s, my grandfather, who had taught law here at the University of Illinois for 40 years, had been a professor here, taught business law, Essel Dillavu. After the Democratic Convention, when the Chicago police had rioted were very violent towards the relatively peaceful demonstrators at the Democratic Convention in 68, the next week I went out to see my grandfather and was telling him how I'd seen the police personally with my own eyes beat innocent people, and he literally couldn't believe it, because he'd been dedicated to the law and order all of his life. And his own grandson, a seminary student who tried with other seminary students from Catholic and Protestant seminaries to go stand between the police after the first night of violence and the demonstrators, he couldn't even believe my eyewitness testimony. Now, we've talked about how eyewitness testimony can be very, very wrong, but later evidence showed that I was right. But it was very hard for my grandfather and many people of his generation in the 60s. And I think that's true again in our culture today. And Illinois particularly has this culture of corruption at so many levels of government, all the way from people who run drainage ditches and county, anywhere there's money in a government, there's just places for corruption, and whether it's the highways and roads folks or wherever, or the police, there's just so, it seems to be so endemic to our state culture. Professor, do you talk about that in your class?
we do talk about that, you know, although I think it's framed in a slightly different way, which is the inability and unwillingness of both public officials and those in power throughout the entire legal system to acknowledge the fact that mistakes get made. So there are two parts of this. One is there are certain ways in which the system of folks actually engages in mistakes, but then there's the other issue, which is the one that we're concerned about and that Mike's talking about, which is what is the reaction of people when, in fact, they're faced with the fact that there might have been a serious error in the work that they've done? And that is where we really begin to see both defensiveness, resistance, and then every once in a while, like in this case, and a couple of the others that we've been involved in, we begin to see that it goes beyond that to the fact that there was corruption of various kinds in terms that resulted in the convictions to begin with. That's not true in all cases. In many of the cases, there's no political corruption involved. But the fact that law enforcement and not just law enforcement, but the entire legal community, the prosecuting attorneys, sometimes the judges, just hunker down and will not. There's something about our culture also where people in public positions are unwilling to acknowledge when they make errors and mistakes.
Or when someone else has made a mistake who's within the system.
That's right.
Yeah. Now,
and
did
that's
it help
a very
at all?
Serious problem.
How much did it help in Illinois when U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald came here?
Oh, I think he's been a blessing to the state of Illinois. He is the one man that's come in and made any type of difference, and on a personal basis, he's given me the hope that I had lost a long time ago of anything ever being done right. You know, the man's a godsend for this state, and I hope the people and the citizens of this state realize that and give him their full support.
Let me interrupt our conversation for a moment to again say this is WILL, a listener-supported service of Illinois Public Media, AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, and found online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs, and I want to thank Don Nolan for often filling in when he has a special guest interview or when I'm unavailable. We're talking today with Larry Golden, a professor at the University of Illinois in Springfield and head of the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project. If you'd like to support that work, you may go to that website, search for Downstate Illinois Innocence Project. Mike Callahan is the author of the book we're discussing today, Too Politically Sensitive. You've been interviewed many times, Michael, since this book was published last April. You self-published this book because you really wanted to tell your story in your own words and to get the facts out as you saw them. And as I was reading it, it struck me as kind of an extended blog. I mean, you're just putting your whole self out there and letting people know your feelings as well as the facts that you discovered. When this book came out, it's this case, and you have been featured in 48 Hours, the TV show 48 Hours. There's been three episodes about this case. It's coming up January 10 and 11 on television on the Discovery Channel that people with Dish Network can get on the case with Paula Zahn. That's January 10 and 11. That will later be on the Learning Channel that others people will be able to find. This case has really been seen as so important and so central, and that's one reason that even though Celeste Quinn interviewed you earlier about your book, I wanted to have you today on Keeping the Faith because of particularly the moral and ethical issues involved. What do you see the biggest ethical issues from your perspective as a former 25-year Illinois State Police officer?
Well, one of the things that we talked about just a few minutes ago was the justice system, and I'm afraid that the justice system has become an adversarial system that's about winning and losing, where you have attorneys or state's attorneys where it's more important to win a case than really tell the truth or seek the truth and have real justice. And that's one of the themes of this book, because I think the people, they want truth and justice. They don't want a system of just winning and losing. They don't want that pound of flesh. Obviously, there's a lot of victims in this case. You know, Dyke and Karen Rhodes, Randy Steidel, Herb Whitlocker. And this is probably one of the most egregious cases I've ever seen in my career. And then when you throw in the frightening example of the First Amendment being taken away from people like myself, or maybe in the future it'll be the news reporter or the journalist, as you see with Dave Protas, the Center for Wrongful Conviction in Cook County right now. And if the government wants to silence those people that are going to expose its misconduct, then the public's never going to see any misconduct, are they?
Larry Golden, what are the major ethical issues you see that this case has illustrated?
Well, I think that Michael's certainly right in pointing to the whole question of what is the meaning of justice and how do we achieve it. The slight difference I might have with him is having studied the justice system, the legal justice system in our country, I've always understood it as an adversarial system, and it has been about winning and losing. And we need to relook at that question in terms of, in fact, how we want to redefine justice. And it's going to ultimately need some fundamental changes in terms of the way we do things, in terms of the prosecution of people, and trying to even that playing field off in such a way that we don't make these kinds of mistakes. I think the second is one that maybe Mike's a little less willing to talk about again, and that is the role of people like him in the system and the importance that I try to emphasize to my students when they go out of being willing to stand up and fight for what is right, and to in fact do that and make decisions about how important that is for them, no matter what the consequences are. It's a very difficult position for anybody to be put in, to have to choose between exposing something which is terribly wrong, and possibly their careers, livelihoods, and even their safety. I think that's a huge issue that this case has demonstrated.
Let's talk a little. Bit about that with Mike Callahan. What in your life, Mike, gave you the courage to take all this on?
Oh, I think that number one, I felt ashamed for what had happened. I looked and saw the pain of the Rhodes family when they asked us for help, when the Innocence Project came to us and asked us for help, and we as an organization let those people down. And I took an oath not to let people down, and I was appalled and I was ashamed.
Did you were you raised in any, with any particular ethical or religious tradition?
Oh yes, my family was very religious and very ethical. My father was always, you know, tell the truth and tell the truth no matter what. Always do the right thing, and he said, "I will always stand by you as long as you tell the truth and you do the right thing." And I believe that, and I believe that's why I became a police officer. And you know, if as far as the ramifications of what could have happened to my family and I mean, think you're trained early on as a police officer. You can't be afraid. If you are, then evil's going to surely win. If the police officers and the police are afraid, then who's going to combat evil?
And where did you learn what evil was first?
I guess when you're, you know, you always have that sense of right and wrong, and now obviously I've obviously discovered that there's wrong within my own organization, or in this case, the good guys were actually the bad guys. So
some of them,
and so I guess, you know, it's your own sense of justice and right and wrong, and I think that you're taught that as you grow up, and I think we all have an idea of what's ethical and what's immoral, and you know, leaving innocent men in prison is obviously very unethical, and not searching for the real killers is very unethical and immoral, and it's not what – I don't think there's a citizen in this country that wants that for anyone. And certainly yet, you wouldn't want it to happen to yourself.
And yet so many people today seem to be motivated by other ethics and other values. Clearly some of the people you describe in your book were – motivated by power, by money, by getting elected again, by keeping their position and their six-figure pension when they retired from the Illinois State Police. Can I push you a little bit further to say where you got your idea of right and wrong, which is different than theirs?
I think that it's born within each of us. Whatever caused those people to go against their oath, you know, they'll have to answer that question. I can't answer that for them. I can't imagine in my life ever ignoring the truth, and that's why I kept standing up. And you know, my wife was my strength. She stood by me, and she said, "You can't let this happen. You need to fight back. You can't be quiet about this." My family, I could have easily been quiet, and my family would have gone on with no problems, and we would have been probably more financially secure than we are today. But she was that strength that said, "You need to stand up because I know you too well. This will tear you apart internally because you are not about standing by and letting something like this go unexposed."
And Professor Golden, in your class you teach on these kind of issues, do you when you talk about wrongful convictions, what kind of ethics are you assuming?
Well, you know, the problem is we live in a diverse society, so I can't assume that everybody comes into that room with the same sense of right and wrong. But there is a commonality within our society and our culture, sufficient enough so that one can at least be able to say to people, I'm not going to teach them what is right and what is wrong. What my sense, other than an understanding of the whole problem of wrongful convictions, but what I want to do is to instill within them a sense of the fact that these things that we're looking at, the cases that we're looking at, have injustice of such great proportions that I would hope that they would understand that if they were ever put in the position of a Michael Callahan or under in the the Lando Cruz case, there were a number of heroes. Mary Bridget Kenny, who was, in fact, an assistant attorney general under Roland Burris at that time, refused to follow through on an appeal that Roland Burris was insisting as attorney general should be filed because she believed that Rolando Cruz was innocent and that it shouldn't be happening. There were people like Detective Sam who resigned his position in law enforcement as a result of that case. And the only way we're going to be able to push forward in terms of dealing with these kinds of problems is if the people who are involved at the levels of being asked to carry it out basically say no, that I cannot do that. That is not right, and like Mike Callahan, but hopefully not having to suffer the consequences, but that unfortunately, that's historically, we know that people who fight for justice, for right and wrong, are often people who do have to suffer some of those external consequences. But as Mike says, at least, he can go home at night and sleep soundly. And be comfortable with him and his family and the people who know him and hold his head up high. What I wonder about is all of those other people who are around Mike and who participated in these cases, who know that there are problems, and who, for whatever reasons, are unable or unwilling to do that.
We're talking with Professor Larry Golden from the Downstate Innocence Project at the University of Illinois in Springfield, and with Michael Callahan, the author of Too Politically Sensitive, Since When Is Murder Too Politically Sensitive, a book that came out just this year, just last April. It's available in local bookstores and online. Simply go look for Too Politically Sensitive. There is a website, toopoliticallysensitive.com, where you can find out how to order that. That's T-O-O, and Michael is spelled M-I-C-H-A-L-E, Michael Callahan, toopoliticallysensitive.com to order this book. It's a difficult book because it's a difficult case. It's very involved. You give a lot of evidence in here. There are hundreds of names of people that are involved. You have a very helpful thing at the beginning where you list people by category and who they are so people can, like in when you're reading a Dostoevsky novel, you can go and see who the list of characters are. That's helpful. But it is difficult, but it is rewarding to read, and I'd encourage readers to get all the way through it and see what's at the end as well as at the beginning because it's very important as we think about the culture of justice in particularly the state of Illinois right now. It, of course, has implications for other states as well. We still have time for one caller, perhaps. So if someone would like to give us a call, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Long distance, 1-800-222-9455. I understand, of course, with a complicated issue like this one, people often just want to listen, and that's fine. But if you have a comment or question, do give us a call. Keep your comment short because we're about out of time. Let me ask Professor Golden one more thing. What is the Downstate Innocence Project working on right now?
Well, we have two cases. One we've been working on for, gosh, now almost 8 years, which is the case of a family in Decatur that was three members of a family who were convicted of the killing. Many of your listeners probably are familiar with it. It was the killing of a young woman by the name of Karen Slover and her ex-husband, Michael, and his mother and father were convicted on the flimsiest of evidence. And I say that because I'm well aware of what happened at the trial. Forget, what we found in terms of, follow-up investigation. And are serving life sentences in prison, all three of them.
I'm going to have to interrupt you because we do have a caller. Let's get this line number one on the air from Rantoul. Go ahead, please.
Hello. Mr. Callahan, I really got to say, I admire you for what you're doing. And I have a question for both of the guests. Given the current economic climate of Illinois, I mean, we're practically bankrupt. What is its impact on justice in the state of Illinois? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
That's a great question. Who wants to go first?
Well, I will, because what's amazing to me is recently and before the Ethics Commission, I have a Twitter where Lisa Madigan basically says she doesn't trust the Illinois State Police to investigate anything involving the governor's office. That was before the recent Ethics Commission. Yet Lisa Madigan, by statute, is supposed to defend all state police personnel, all state personnel. And in my case, she paid $1.3 million to private attorneys out of Chicago to fight my freedom of speech case. And then she's also paying several million dollars to those same attorneys to fight Randy Steidel and Herb Whitlock's lawsuits, civil lawsuits for their wrongful conviction, which is amazing to me why she isn't defending them when the state is in such an economic crunch.
I have a slightly different take on it, and that is that in order to reform the system to deal with the problems that we're talking about, including problems that Mike has pointed out, the state is going to have to put more resources up front. I mean, a good example is the whole issue of providing legal help to people who are in prison who may be wrongfully convicted. Again, people who are not sentenced to death.
Larry, we're going to have to leave it at that. I'm sorry. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more comment or question. Yes, line one, Urbana.
Yes, sir. Professor Golden, I heard you say that you said there was a diverse population of people, and perhaps you didn't want to tell people what was wrong and right. But I mean, isn't goodness fundamental, something that everyone can agree on?
Well, leave that question there. Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I mean, I also went on and said that there are certain kinds of common things that we can agree on that define what is just within our society. But I'm not going to get down to the fine nuances. All I was saying is that we are a multicultural society with various traditions, and in a class like I'm teaching, it's not a religious class, it's not an ethics class where I'm going to dictate to them. But it's fairly clear to people by the time they get done with our class, and Mike can tell you that too, he's talked to the students, that they have a pretty good sense across the board of what's right and wrong in terms of these kinds of issues.
We are out of time. Let me thank our guests again, Professor Larry Golden, who was just speaking to us very kindly by phone from the East Coast, who is director of the Downstate Illinois Innocence Project at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And the course he teaches is on wrongful convictions. And our other guest, Mike Callahan, who is the author of the recently published book, Too Politically Sensitive, T-O-O, Too Politically Sensitive. You can go to toopoliticallysensitive.com to order the book or find in local bookstores or online. His name is spelled M-I-C-H-A-L-E, Michael Callahan, C-A-L-L-A-H-A-N. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith. Next week, I'll be talking to Kim Bobo, who's the Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.